Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
21 years ago, John Judas and Rui Teixeira wrote a book that defined a political era. In The Emerging Democratic Majority, Judas and Teixeira argued that America's demographic destiny belonged to the Democrats. A left-of-center coalition of minorities, young people, women, and knowledge economy professionals was going to allow the Dems to break through the political stalemate that defined the early 2000s and perhaps even create an FDR-style realignment. 2 years after the book's publication in 2004, Barack Obama was elected to the Senate from Illinois, and he seemed to be the perfect avatar for this new Democratic majority. In 2008, Obama put together the very coalition that Judas and Teixeira described in their book, and he won the White House. Democratic strategists pointed to the Judas-Teixeira theory and confidently predicted that their party now had a lock on the Electoral College. Then, Donald Trump came along and picked the lock. Now, Judas and Teixeira are back with their explanation about what happened. And their new book, Where Have All the Democrats Gone, is not likely to be embraced so warmly by the party that they both say they want to succeed. Democrats, they write, need to look in the mirror and examine the extent to which their own failures contributed to the rise of the most toxic tendencies on the right. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. John Judas.
You know, I voted for Bernie, but I recognize that he would have been a disaster.
And Rui Teixeira.
But, you know, Biden is not the party. The party is a much broader entity.
Have been important intellectuals in many of the left's prestige institutions. The New Republic, the Center for American Progress, and the Brookings Institution, just to name a few. But in Where Have All the Democrats Gone, they point to two culprits that, despite the electoral successes of the Biden era, they believe are crippling the Democrats' long-term potential. One is pro-Wall Street, pro-Silicon Valley economic policies embraced by Bill Clinton, Obama, and other party elites for decades. And two is what they call the cultural radicalism of the modern progressive movement, which they dub the Shadow Party, and that they argue is alienating working-class voters on four key issues: race, immigration, transgender rights, and climate. In perhaps the most controversial chapters of the book, they argue that on those four issues, Democrats should be occupying a middle ground somewhere between Trump and the far left, but instead have been pushed to the extremes by the activists of the so-called Shadow Party. Teixeira's personal political journey and his alienation from the modern progressive movement since he co-wrote The Emerging Democratic Majority is evidenced by the location of our interview, a conference room at the American Enterprise Institute, where he now works. This is a book that reads like worthy but innocuous political history in its early chapters, but by the end is pouring gasoline on the ideological fires that have been burning among progressives and moderates ever since the 2016 Democratic primaries. And it is now causing a firestorm of debate and criticism among politicians, pundits, strategists, and thinkers on the left. So, where have all the Democrats gone? Let's start with very briefly with the emerging Democratic majority, which the two of you will forever be famous for. No matter what else you do, you'll be well known for that. Which came out in 2002.
Written in 2001 in the fall.
All right. So
during 9/11,
you quote someone calling you guys seers in your more recent book, and you did predict what came to be called the Obama coalition. And there's an interesting part in this book where you note that as the two of you were rethinking the theory
of the emerging Democratic majority. There were all these other progressives doubling down on it.
Yes.
Tell me about that moment when the two of you were starting to rethink that and others were saying, oh, it's the emerging Democratic majority. We're fine. We've got this coalition that is unstoppable.
Well, that was really, I think that was 2014 in particular, after that election.
So it's post-Obama era, because the thesis survives through the Obama era pretty...
Well, we had doubts in 2010 after that election, but those theories about the ascendant, new, rising American majority really come to the fore, I think, about 2014. I was in 2015, I was doing a story on that Democracy Alliance, the big funders thing. And that was central to their thinking. So that's where I really ran across this full bore. Rui was at the Center for American Progress. So he was also in the belly of the beast, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, yeah, 2010, definitely is when we start to see the cracks. Because actually, even in 10 through 2008, I noticed that even though Obama had done relatively well among white working class voters, no one is paying the slightest attention to that. It was more about, you know, the minorities, the college educated. It was sort of the rising American electorate, what came to be called the coalition of the ascendant. But 2010, it crashes and burns. Democrats lose 63 seats. They crash in the Midwest, particularly among white working class voters, but a lot of places around the country. 2012, Obama manages to get a second term. And importantly, and completely ignored again, it's a lot because he manages to bring back a lot of these white working class voters from 2010 in the upper Midwest, running on a more populist campaign, using the auto bailout against Mitt Romney and so on. It's really after 2012 that the whole rising American electorate coalition of the ascendant, you know, becomes a catechism in Democratic circles. It even survives 2014 when the Democrats have another bad midterm, and it obviously survives into 2016 with the campaign of Hillary Clinton and how she was thinking and her campaign team were thinking about the electorate and about the election and about the role of the white working class, which they did not expect to be a big problem, which of course turned out to be completely wrong. And then after 2016, despite, you know, this shock to the system of the rising American electorate, bizarrely again, this gets summed up as well. You know, all the people who didn't vote for us are just racists and xenophobes. And what can we do about that? We have to double down on the coalition of the ascendant and the rising American electorate. So I think
we didn't have enough votes in Milwaukee and Detroit. And, you know, if we did that, we would have changed the election.
It's a matter of turning out our people.
This is the Democratic analysis of which election? This may be getting ahead of things, but how much was one related to the other? If the Democratic Party is going to become higher income and more professional class, is it by necessity going to be a more uncomfortable coalition with the white working class? Although we'll get to the fact that you guys point out in the book that it's no longer correct to just say white working class. It's a working class that the Democrats are losing. But anyway, should we have predicted that there would be tension and that the coalitions would shift the way that they have?
Well, I think we should have predicted that, the potential was there, right? The interests, cultural and economic, of working class voters, as opposed to college educated voters, particularly in these ideopolises we talked about, they aren't necessarily the same.
I wanted to remind people that you had a word for these places like the research triangle
we
in North Carolina.
It would catch on,
I thought it was great. But then I noticed in the new book, you used some other guy's phrase.
Well, you know. I think the divide really opens up in the late 20th century. We talk about that a lot in the first part of our book about the Great Divide, how the Democrats gradually lose the faith of a lot of working class, especially white working class voters, on economic issues. They are all for free trade. They kind of embrace a soft neoliberalism. Clinton does the financial deregulation, and the labor movement precipitously declines in this period, which sort of eliminates or vastly weakens the working class anchor of the party, both economically and culturally. And then you get into the 21st century, that really doesn't change that economic orientation, and it gets reinforced by the cultural distance that kind of starts really sort of getting wider and wider between working class voters and college educated voters, particularly the liberal college educated voters who had streamed into the Democratic Party and dominated, which I think is a very important thing we emphasized in the book, the shadow party.
Yes.
Of the Democrats.
Let's define the shadow party.
The shadow party is
this conversation.
Sort of penumbra of nonprofits, advocacy groups, media companies, foundations, a good, huge chunk of academia, intellectuals. There's a whole like vast array of these groups that are significantly supported by donations from the rich and from now you see it from small donors. And they have a huge role in defining what the party stands for, what its priorities are, what it pushes, what its brand is, so to speak. And all that pushes the Democrats away from a cultural outlook and an economic orientation that is mostly about working, aspiring working and middle class people. The priorities of these voters and their supportive shadow party is just pretty different. And Democrats. It's sort of like they weren't even aware it was happening when it was happening. And by the time you reach the politics of today, it's like nobody can think outside of that structure.
I mean,
this is our party. This is what we have. We have to stick with this. We have to stick with our, orientation on all these issues. Otherwise, these liberal college-educated people at the big cities will desert us, and that would be a tragedy.
Yeah, no, I was going to say it really burst into the open in 2016 in that election. And what you have there most clearly is the economic differences underpin a huge cultural differences. If you go to, again, mid-sized town, small town like Mansfield, Ohio, where Sherrod Brown was born, those are towns where a lot of the factories have closed. The neighborhoods no longer exist. And in a sense, the people there are thrown back upon the verities, nation, family, guns to protect the home, faith. If you go to a big city and you find people, when I first moved to Washington, I used to count how long it would take me for one of these big shots to tell me what college he went to. And if it wasn't, and if you also went to a prep school, you'd also learn that too.
Yeah.
They have a multiplicity of identities, live many places, cosmopolitan, belongs to a firm, used to be in Mansfield, Ohio, you worked for the same company and your kids were going to no longer. So you have this enormous cultural difference. And it happens in Europe too, the same thing. Brexit vote was the same pattern that is underpinned by these economic differences.
All right, well, a lot to unpack here with the shadow party and these cultural changes. I guess what I'm trying to wrap my head around with that is, in your experience, and Rui, you were in a sense you were at the Center for American Progress, which you identify in the two of you identify in the book as part of the shadow party.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about some of the media organs of the shadow party. You say the New York Times and Vox, the sort of liberal media establishment, the think tanks, the donor networks, mm-hmm. like NARAL and Emily's List and the Democracy Alliance. The ACLU. So all of these institutions that our listeners will be very familiar with. A lot of it reminds me of what when we talk about primaries, the invisible primary. It's the groups that kind of whittle the field in the early running, and that's existed for a long time. But do you all think that in the last 2 to 3 decades that the Democratic shadow party has, one, grown much, much larger, and two, much, much more influential? Is it, in other words, is it, how new is it?
Social media. That's the key. I mean, you used to be able to define a political party by its kind of governing coalition. And, the joke used to be it was all the Eastern Seaboard people, and they were interchangeable in terms of cabinets. Council on Foreign Relations, again, AFL-CIO was important. What you start to get in the 2000s because of social media is just this proliferation of groups that have a very wide influence. And the party themselves becomes defined by them. I mean, I use a silly example. In 1980, Ronald Reagan, you know, was elected by partly by moral majority and right religious right.
Right, which that's so part the of way the Republican he, shadow party.
Right, exactly. But there wasn't a shadow party then in the same sense, because he could deal with them by appointing somebody from the religious right to be a deputy assistant secretary of education, and nobody would have heard of him except for, you know, Jerry Falwell would know and be very grateful.
Yeah.
And Reagan wouldn't necessarily go to the anti-abortion rallies. So the part, he didn't become identified nationally with that cause.
Yeah.
Biden appoints what Rachel Levine, a trans person, to what, assistant secretary of
HHS,
health, of
think?
HHS. Yeah. All over the internet, right? Big issue.
Right.
It's just
becomes an
again,
issue in Congress. It becomes an oversight issue.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And the party becomes identified with them, and Republicans run ads and look at this person who's a big shot. So it's, again, I think social media changes it a lot, and it encourages the extremes in each party, because the groups themselves that make up the shadow party aren't necessarily interested in making up political majorities. They're interested in their donors. They're interested in this activist base that they want to stir up. So they're
and policy at the end of the day.
Right. And even in newspapers now aren't dependent upon ads, but on subscribers. So they have to, you know, they have to think about what their subscribers care about. So you have this shadow party, which the Democrats become, and the Republicans on their side also become identified with, that doesn't necessarily conducive to building majorities.
Well, yeah, and I think the another important aspect of this is, you know, because of the way the shadow party evolves, because of the role of social media and other things John's mentioning, the shadow party not only becomes larger and more influential, it becomes more unified. I mean, all of their positions on all of the issues are the same. Everybody's got the same position on trans, you know, so-called trans rights or trans issues. They got the same position on immigration, the same position on race, the same position on crime and how, you know, we shouldn't be law and order. Instead, we should really be mostly concerned with do no harm and, you know, sort of making sure there isn't disparate impact from the influence of laws.
Coordinating?
They're not exactly, no, they're just, they live in the same bubble.
Okay.
And they're influenced by each other. And the people who come in and run these organizations and staff them all have the same points of view. So there's real constraint between and among these positions, among people in the shadow party. So if, you know, the ACLU famously becomes much more than just a civil liberties or Planned Parenthood says to fund the police. There's so many examples of it. Sierra Club says we must fight white supremacy.
And the language too. Yeah. Latinx.
The same language, the same points of view.
Of he or she. And if you don't use those terms, you're in trouble. Yeah.
So the shadow party is a bubble, and that bubble determines a lot of the influence and is heavily influences the view people have about the Democratic Party and the language they use and the issues they care about. And I think that's makes a huge difference. And it's hard for someone like Biden, who I think of as sort of the designated normie of the Democratic Party, to dissociate himself from it. He may get up there and say in a State of the Union address to fund the police, but that does not get rid of the shadow party. That doesn't get rid of his influence. That doesn't get rid of, you know, the whole constellation of influences that come to bear between the media and a variety of other places that sort of push a certain line. He can't stop that, and that's part of the problem.
I want you to define the Fox News fallacy, which is related to to what we're talking about here. And I just want you to sort of address that in this part of the conversation, because one of the points you make about that is that the extremism of the right, and maybe that's the wrong word, but there's something going on the right that has blinded Democrats to some of their own internal issues. And related to that is if they see something on Fox News, then you automatically have to take the opposite view. Just unpack that, the Fox News fallacy.
Right, okay, that was a locution I came up with, the Fox News fallacy. The basic concept is pretty simple. The typical reaction of Democratic activists, intellectuals, people in you know, commenters on social media, whatever, who are Democratic oriented. If something is said that criticizes the Democrats, you know, on Fox News or the Washington Free Beacon or by some conservative, it's automatically wrong. And the job of Democrats is to deny there's anything to it. And in fact, not only to deny there's anything to it, but to accuse anyone who would say anything similar as giving into racism, giving into xenophobia, giving into Trumpism. It's all made up by Fox News, and you know, people are being panicked by what they see on the media. This is not a big deal. No real voters care about this, but that's completely wrong. Real voters do care about this. And they do have questions about the Democrats, and they do want public safety. I mean, you know, look at the fund the police and how it, you know, sort of took over briefly the you know, the liberal discourse on crime and race. I mean, the last people who wanted to see defund the police were Black voters who lived in poor areas. They wanted more police. Their priority was public safety. Defunding the police was a crackpot idea. And so you see this over and over again. Abolish ICE and, you know, sort of decriminalize illegal immigration. These are terrible ideas. Voters really are concerned about them. They really don't want an open border. And when Fox News says the same thing, or the Washington Free Beacon says the same thing, or the conservative bete noire of your choice says the same thing, they're talking about a real issue that real voters care about. And you're not going to persuade anybody against that point of view if you simply act like the problem doesn't exist. And this is all made up by the satanic, anti-democratic, quasi-fascist people on the other side.
I mean, it even affects very sophisticated analyses. I mean, I deal a lot with the issue of immigration over the last, 10 years, 15 years, written a lot about it. And we even got this criticism already in a review of the book where somebody says that, accuses us of wanting to restrict immigration when what we want to do is restrict unskilled and semi-skilled workers who have been competing with the workers who are already here.
Well, and also the fact that immigration is now largely on the left viewed through the prism of race and, for lack of a better word, wokeness. So your position on immigration is much less defined by the kind of economic view of the world, but rather, are you sympathetic to this class of people, this class of people? Am I
yeah,
wrong?
If you want
that?
Border security, yeah. It's because you don't like brown people. You don't like the idea.
More succinct than I just said.
You don't like the idea that America is becoming a glorious multiracial, multicultural society. You just want to preserve your white privilege and white status. And that the only reason why you might object to like having a porous border and having people pour across it. Of course, that's completely, completely wrong. And a great example of the Fox News fallacy, as I was saying, people are concerned about this. Look at the whole, I think it is connected to the issue of race. Look at the whole vogue for characterizing the United States as a white supremacist society, shot through a structural racism, born in slavery, marinated in racism forever. Now, if you object to that in Democratic circles, this is particularly kind of crested with the George Floyd summer, but it's still with us today. The whole idea that we should be a colorblind society, that we should be all about equal opportunity, that's quasi-racism. But, you know, to simply raise reasonable questions about whether this is the correct view of the United States will get you in a lot of hot water in a lot of places. And I especially include the left institutional world of which I used to be a part.
Let's just quickly talk a little bit about the economic piece of this as well. Yeah. You do a good job in the book of running through the, you know, neoliberal project of Democratic presidencies from Carter through Obama. And which a lot of it is about financial deregulation and the related issue of engagement with China. Of all of the kind of, you know, neoliberal Bob Rubin view of the world policies that Democratic presidents pursued in those three presidencies, and then we'll talk about Biden separately. Mm-hmm. What are the most economically catastrophic from your perspective for the working class?
Well, I would say NAFTA. the terms on which we got China to be part of the WTO, which we were always, it had to be unanimous. So we played the key role there in defining their entry.
Right. If we'd been opposed to it, conditions. It wouldn't happen. Yeah.
I'd say that those were critical. I'd also say the immigration, again, not being cognizant of what this was going to do. Among other things, to Black Americans who had only a high school education, who after 1965 suddenly found themselves in a position where they could protest against discrimination, but where they also found themselves competing for jobs with the immigrants. And that was I think that's a key factor that a lot of people just don't recognize. And the third thing I'd say—
In other words, an economic argument about— maybe I'll ask this in a different way when you finish your question.
The third thing I'd say is something that you could describe as welfarism in terms of the policies. Adopting policies that are have the result of making the middle class pay for the working or lower classes for programs, but not themselves receiving any benefit for them. In contrast to, let's say, Social Security or Medicare, again, a program that the labor movement was absolutely crucial in getting adopted. Obamacare, why was it so unpopular? Well, it turned out that if you made, let's say, $60,000 more a year, your premiums went up. If you made less than that, they were subsidized. So, you know, the Obama wonks could argue, well, your premium's going up less than it might have otherwise. But for a lot of people, and they were in a position where they were going to have to pay for the other people. Yeah. I think that's another reason why Medicaid, some of those states didn't take Medicaid. I mean, they saw, again, the program as their constituencies saw it as welfarism. And it's not, you can't reduce it to racism. It was just, you know, we're paying for other people. And that's the form that that a lot of Democratic legislation starts to take in the 60s. And that's the form it takes in the 90s, the earned income tax credit, all these kinds of things. So that's a problem for Democrats.
The accession of China to the WTO really, really is key. You know, what that does to a lot of places around the country, particularly in the Midwest, and, you know, deindustrialization that results from it. There's actually very good studies that have been done by David Autor et al., economist David Autor, that basically shows this incredibly strong relationship between where the China shock hit and movements toward the Republicans in those particular geographical areas. So, I mean, that's very obvious and very key to how Trump is able to run in 2016 and Democrats lose the faith in their economic program among a lot of these voters. Another thing, though, that's worth mentioning is financial deregulation. I think that the movement toward dereg in the Clinton administration and the sort of the Rubenomics wasn't particularly popular at the time. But it identified the Democrats with the views and priorities and the economics of that sector. And obviously that comes home to bite in 2008, 2009 with the Great Recession. And, you know, the Democrats just are not in a good position to recover faith in their economic model when they have, in a sense, helped along this catastrophic economic problem. And then, of course, you had this very slow recovery from it.
And then they don't do anything about the bankers.
Yeah, I mean, they don't do anything about the bankers. That was so underestimated at the time. Yeah. You know, Rubin and Geithner says, we can't touch these people. And, you know, normie voters, working class voters, say, what? These people just totally screwed us? They crashed the economy and you're not going to do anything to them? I think that was a real cut point in a way.
The two threads that you're tracing here are the what you call later in the book, the cultural radicalism of the Democrats. And the economic piece of this, you point out that Clinton and Democrats, when they actually governed, they were highly influenced by Wall Street and Silicon Valley, and that's the problem with the economic project. There's a stat in there that you say that since 2012, Democrats lost 25 points among non-white working class. In other words, the erosion in the working in the white working class becomes gradually is becoming no longer segmented racially the way it used to. But are those the two big threads that lead to this decline?
But here's the connection. I mean, this is why I think that in our book we make so much in the beginning of the 70s and 80s and the decline of the labor movement as a central factor in democratic politics. Because by the 90s, what you get is a governing coalition of the Democratic Party that's on the one hand, democratic business interests, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and on the other hand, the groups that come out of the 60s, feminist, civil rights, environmental. And so you get this kind of progressive neoliberalism. It's a term that the philosopher Nancy Fraser uses that I think fits it, that dominates the party. So you get economics that really does it, that really misses out on this old working class base, and you get cultural politics that appeal primarily, again, to college-educated voters within these post-industrial metropolitan cities and in college towns. And it really, again, crystallizes in 2016, I think, that election, because Trump, you know, for all the complaints about how stupid he is, got it. I mean, he understood that. He went right at both those things.
Well, yeah, and you want to jump in here, but your account of the Trump campaign and your analysis of it was, I found very interesting, a couple of points that I want you guys to respond to. One is you cited a statistic that 70% of Trump's ads were about policy, and that was more than Hillary Rodham Clinton's. I think if you asked anyone who had one candidate's ads were 70% about policy, which one was it? They would all have guessed
right,
Hillary.
Yeah. Well, Hillary had lots of plans, you know. I mean, before Elizabeth Warren was talking about, I have a plan for that. Hillary had a plan for that. She had an elaborate policy program that, you know, the working class people should have realized was in their interest. But what did she run on? You know, what is the contact people had with the campaign through ads and stuff like that? It was all about how bad Donald Trump was, what a bad person he was, how sexist he was, how racist he was, how we're all in this together against the bad orange man. That was the nature of the advertising, like 80, 90%. Whereas Trump, you know, he may not have run on a specific detailed policy program about trade, about runaway shops, about immigration.
I think that's an understatement.
But he talked about it all the time. He talked about how the elites were betraying you. He talked about, you know, bad trade deals. He talked about how, you know, we're going to fix everything and here's how we're going to do it in very broad terms. He talked about issues. You may not have liked how he talked about issues and it may not have been very specific, but he talked about issues. Whereas Hillary talked about bad orange man.
And I think the other aspect was the identity politics that from Hillary Clinton's side. I mean, it was striking that Obama did not run as a black candidate, and he really steered away from that. He very much had he very much understood the lessons of the New Democrats in terms of social policy. Hillary Clinton, you know, burst through the glass ceiling in her convention. I'm with her. The whole idea that vote for me because I'm a woman. And I think, again, that was another aspect of missing the boat and not appealing to what voters really cared about.
I mean, another wrinkle of this is, you know, how the primary campaign went in 2016 between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. She was really under threat or felt under threat from Bernie Sanders. And one way she responded to that in his class-oriented appeal and against the billionaire class and the banks, you know, she started this call and response thing in a lot of her rallies, which is like, if we got rid, you know, broke up the big banks, would that get rid of racism? No. If we broke up the big banks, would that get rid of sexism? No. If we broke up the big banks, would that, you know, preserve LGBTQ rights? No. So, you know, this was like her shtick.
And
you know, it's pure identity politics.
She used to attack him for being against the 2008 immigration reform, and he was against it Because of the there are H2Bs and 1Bs, but they all ended up replacing people at Disneyland, you know, or the workers had to train the people. I mean, that's what he was against, but that's what she was attacking.
But that, yeah, and that call and response that Rui just mentioned is sort of pure distillation of the difference between those campaigns.
Yeah.
One's about identity politics and one's a classic economics, about economics and class.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing that, you know, one big takeaway from the book, it's Democrats focus on class, not race. Would you agree with that?
They should. That they
should. Yeah, you should.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't mean, I'm sorry. This is a command. This is said as a commandment from the two of you.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yes, that's the commandment.
Well, I guess our basic, you know, shtick, and we talk about this at the end of the book, is Democrats have done best as a party, as a potential dominant electoral coalition, when they've been the party of the common man and woman, of the ordinary American, of the forgotten American. And that identity as being the party that represents those kind of people in our country, was so key to Democrat success when they've done the best. And that's really, to a large extent, what's been lost. And you can see that in the survey data and so on, which party is for the common man and woman. It's really changed over time. And, you know, obviously, when Democrats are slicing and dicing the electorate into a variety of different intersectional buckets, and talking about equity instead of equal opportunity, and, you know, saying this is a country where, you know, all black and brown people are oppressed. I mean, this is not designed to unify the common man and woman behind the project of the Democratic Party. It's something very different.
Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Now we need to talk about the problematic case of Joe Biden and his successes.
Mm-hmm.
I think you deal with this in a nuanced way in the book, but he seems to be a living rebuke to some of what you're arguing. What is wrong with uniting a coalition around the fact, to use your phrase, orange man bad? Because a lot of people think orange man bad.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So what's wrong with keeping this anti-Trump coalition together from 2018 till just the elections the other day? And so that seems to me.
Disclaimer.
No.
Yeah, time for the disclaimer.
I want to exaggerate a little bit here to just provoke you, but it seems like Democrats are doing okay with the running against what they see as a threat to the country's foundations. And all this other stuff that you guys are talking about in the post-Trump era, we can deal with the nuances of trans rights and climate and immigration and race, which are the four biggies you guys talk about at the end of the book of what are holding Democrats back. And a lot of people say, well, one, they're not holding Democrats back. They're doing great. Mm-hmm. And this coalition to get past the Trump era, whatever's happening underneath in these online debates between in the shadow party, yeah, we'll deal with that. Democrats can deal with that later. For now, what's important is orange man bad and get past the national emergency.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the disclaimer. We are not the political consultants. It may well
Fair.
Be that the Democrats' best shot in 2024 is orange man bad. And orange man has gotten a lot worse since 2020. He's gotten nuttier and nuttier. But I think, again, our basic argument is that as long as you have these parties that are roughly equal electorally and that have to make their appeal on the different parties' extremes, you have a situation in the country of continued stalemate in Washington and an inability to deal with a lot of the big issues that the country faces. And so What we were doing is advocating what it would take to make to create a majority party, so we could deal with the carried interest. I mean, our tax structure is ridiculous. It still encourages companies to go overseas. Hedge funds, the whole world of financial speculation, the degree to which that dominates our economy. So there's so many problems that we have. Obamacare, deeply flawed now still. I mean, my wife and I were trying to get onto Plan D, and you have to have like a business degree now to understand some of that stuff. It's just nuts. Right. So anyway, I think that's what we were looking for. But there's no doubt that in 2024, the election is, part of the Democratic strategy has to be to make Trump look bad. And if people don't think that about him, we'll have another 4 years.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, in addition to Orange Man Bad, let's not forget the other key part of the arsenal, which is abortion rights.
Right.
Yeah.
That's not part of your rap sheet of cultural radicalism that the Democrats should stay away from.
No. Abortion rights is a great issue for the Democrats, because the radicalism in the Republican Party, big sections of it, allows the Democratic Party Democrats to present that we're the moderates. We don't want to take away your freedom. We're for abortion rights. Those other people, they want to ban abortion entirely. And there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who do feel that way. And, if you look at the data on what people feel about abortion rights, it's generally the case that they would prefer a moderate course where abortion would be on demand in the first trimester. Maybe not in the second trimester. People are very leery. Third trimester, definitely not. But the problem is that this election coming up in 2024 is going to be a really different electorate than we've seen in the last several, these off-year cycles, non-presidential year cycles. Democrats have become, in a sense, low turnout election specialists. Their coalition is now such that they have the educated and engaged voters who are going to turn out in these non-presidential years more so than the Republicans. And all the data we have as we look at forward to 2024, and we look at the voters who didn't show up in 2022, for example, but are going to very likely show up in 2024, those are the voters who are most skeptical of Biden, most sympathetic to Trump, most disaffected in general. And therefore, it may not be that easy to replicate success simply with abortion and democracy as it was in some of these off-year elections. So that's a challenge Democrats have. And you see it in Hispanic voters, you see it in young voters, you see it in working class voters. Those people are going to surge into the voting pool, are very much not big enthusiasts for Biden, the Democratic Party, and it's going to make the election in all likelihood quite close, and they could lose. But to underscore John's point, even if the Democrats squeak through in the presidential, that's not exactly dominance. That's not exactly the default majority party for America. They're probably going to lose the Senate, right? Because Manchin they've already lost the West Virginia seat, essentially. It's going to be very difficult for them to retain the Senate. Republicans still dominate state legislatures. They have more governors. They have more trifectas. This is a divided country. If you want to move off the 50-yard line of American politics, Democrats are probably going to have to do something different than Orange Man Bad plus abortion rights.
On the same subject, just in general, how do you think Biden has navigated the two negative trends that you identify in both in his since his 2020 campaign? How has he navigated the shadow party's interest in what you guys call cultural radicalism and the kind of the old neoliberal project that on economics that's dominated Democratic White Houses?
Let's go back to the election in 2020, because I think, as Rui put it, he was the normie candidate. I think if you'd gotten any of those other people, the Democrats would have been in big trouble. But he was a kind of blank slate candidate that Trump couldn't pin any of the big issues on. I mean, I voted for Bernie, but I recognize that he would have been a disaster because, on the one hand, You know, you'd have socialism, and then you'd have raising taxes to pay for Medicare for all. So, and Biden made a point in his campaign about steering away from defund the police. He talked about funding the police. He talked about the United States of America. I mean, that was his theme. He would always say, and so he steered away from multicultural kind of appeals. The election became about Trump. And that's what, you know, that's why he succeeded. Otherwise, not.
Bernie or some of the other, Elizabeth Warren or one of the Pete Buttigieg, you think they wouldn't have had the same?
Yeah, they would have had a lot of problems, yes.
And as
as a president, you know, I think he's made an effort, and his accomplishments the first 2 years, I thought, were miraculous, given that it was a 50-50 Senate, and he got three big bills through. But in terms of the election in 2024, they're really going to be overshadowed by inflation and by his age. Most of the accomplishments of those bills also won't come a cropper until, what, 2028? The infrastructure thing, I mean, for instance.
But it's very commendable that, in my view, that Biden and the Democrats have broken from the basic neoliberal model that Democrats had in one form or another been endorsing or promoting for decades. You know, obviously, they're willing to do something that looks like industrial policy. They're willing to not turn a lot of things over to the market that were previously thought that's realistic economics. So, and you know, as John pointed out, the pure legislative achievement of getting all those bills through is pretty remarkable. But the problem is that, as John also points out, this is going to take quite a while to have its effects, if indeed it has the desirable effects they want. I think there are good reasons to doubt that the bets on renewables and electric vehicles are really going to pay off. But, you know, how are they going to correct that or move farther in the direction they'd like to do once they lose the Senate, once they, you know, if they lose the presidency? Obviously, that's a big problem. And in general, they don't have the political dominance they need to, over time, shift the American economic model towards something that is more beneficial to the broad numbers of working class people, about with among whom they're still suffering greatly in terms of electoral support. This should be a multi-year project. The idea that you could solve the problems of the American economy that have been building for 40 years in 2 years is completely ridiculous. And Democrats really should have been playing for the long haul. In terms of cultural radicalism stuff, I think Biden has made some efforts to dissociate himself from the craziest stuff. But, you know, Biden is not the party, and he has no control, really, over how people present themselves in various states and by various legislators on a lot of these issues. And the Democratic image, or brand, if you will, on a lot of these issues is still way to the left of the median voters, particularly the median working class voter. And Biden is not going to try to change that. Maybe Biden could change that by, you know, sort of a sister soldier moment where he calls out the crazy radicals in his own party on an issue or set of issues, and by name dissociates himself from some of the nuttery. Well, I always liked the idea of a Chesapeake moment, but that's kind of past. But when he got kicked out of being the DA in San Francisco, that was a great opportunity to say, this man does not represent what our party is about.
Well, he did it with the D.C. bill.
Well, that was a bill, though. It wasn't a person. Yeah. But I agree, that was, again, nobody knows about that, and they never talk about it. I mean, one of the things about things Biden does that break a little bit from that culturally radical consensus is he, you know, he doesn't really talk about it. Like the Willow Project in Alaska. You know, I was forced into that. I really didn't want to do it. But, you know, one of the great achievements of administration is they've allowed more oil and gas permits than any previous administration. And that's a lot of the reason why the energy situation hasn't gotten as dire as that, and people are very supportive of this, but they never talk about it because they're worried if they do, the shadow party will come down on them like a ton of bricks. You know, he did this thing recently where we're going to allow a certain portion of the wall to be built between U.S. and Mexico. But the media take on that was, well, you know, they forced me to do it. They put a gun to my head. It's in the law. And you know, they're not going to talk about that. They're not going to talk about border security. So
he has an opportunity coming up with this bill. Because the only way to get the foreign aid, the only way to get Ukraine and Israel aid, it looks like, is going to be a deal on immigration.
That'll be very interesting.
So from your point of view, that this would be an opportunity.
I'd do it. Right. But, you know, I'm just a pointy-headed intellectual. So what? Don't listen to me. Anyway, I got to go.
John, Rui, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having us, Ryan. Right.
Yeah, it was fun.
At this time, Rui had to leave for another podcast. But John is an old friend, and we kept talking.
Yeah.
So, John, in the end of the book, probably the most controversial part of the book is where you're going through a list of four issues that the shadow party, the shadow Democratic Party, cares a lot about. And I'm not going to go into detail on each of them. They're controversial issues. I think you deal with all of them in a nuanced way, but certainly you will be criticized by your friends on the left for saying that Democrats should downplay, well, one, for calling the sort of progressive consensus on these issues radical, and for suggesting in any way that Democrats shouldn't lead with their current views on race, immigration, trans rights, and probably the most controversial one, to me at least, that didn't seem like it necessarily belonged on this list was climate. Didn't seem like that one went with the other one in some way from my perspective. You think, this is a quote from the book, that climate activism has turned into a, quote, millenarian quasi-religious commitment to rapidly zeroing out fossil fuels. Why do you think that the sort of mainstream progressive view on the climate emergency is a huge anchor weighing down Democrats?
Well, politically, it is.
Politically.
That's an easier case to make. I mean, you know, I used to say that, I used to hear that West Virginia went, which used to be the most Democratic state, went for Mondale in 84, Republican was because they were all, you know, whatever, racist, misogynist, but it was climate. And it was Al Gore. And it was the threat to the mining industry and coal mining. And they're, you know, they're losing coal miners, but it's still a big part of the state budget. And it's, again, it's part of what West Virginia is known for. And so add to that Kentucky, Western Pennsylvania. Again, why are the Democrats in some trouble in Pennsylvania? North Dakota used to have, when I came to Washington, two Democratic senators. Now, I don't think you'd find a Democratic official in the whole state. And a lot of that, again, is oil and gas and how it's changed the politics of the state. So in all those respects, the Democratic emphasis on climate has hurt the party. Texas, again, you know, why is Texas a problem? In 2014, it sort of fits two things. I was in San Antonio, and I interviewed people about the governor's race, which was Wendy Davis versus Abbott, and the Hispanic organizers, Latino organizers, Tejano organizers told me, you know, she's not going to do very well among us. We don't care about abortion rights and stuff like that. And sure enough, that was the first real sign for me, because Hispanic men went for Abbott, who was a hardline conservative, over her. Now, if you look at 2020, why did a lot of those places go for Trump? Well, you know, there was public safety. It turned out they weren't happy with illegal immigration, a lot of border security people, but also oil and gas and the industry and the feeling that a lot of people depended upon that.
That helps explain some of the Hispanic turn towards Trump in Texas.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, politically, it's a big issue. I think what Rui and I believe is that there's apocalyptic sentiment that's wrapped into it, a lot of it comes out of the young. I recognize it from my childhood, from the way I used to feel about that nuclear war was going to come all of a sudden. And a lot of the estimates.
It's like the nuclear freeze movement a little bit.
Well, that was already 82. This was when I was a kid, we were doing air safety drills. I mean, we would get under the desk in case, you know, there was a nuclear war.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's more like that. It's more like the sense that the world is going to end. And the projections that people have made, I think, are just wildly unrealistic. 2030 in the United States having eliminating fossil fuels, 2050 globally with all these countries industrializing right now. It's just so, I think that there's been, I think that, again, there's been an era of, you almost call it hysteria around the around climate and around climate legislation that has in turn led to denial on the other side. I mean, it's a sort of psychological problem where somebody screams enough about you, you're going to die. You might think that there's really no problem at all. And so you get on one side, people saying we have to get rid of all fossil fuels by 2030. And, you know, if you look at the science, you have to have fossil fuels in order to have renewables because of the problem of intermittency. So you have that on the one side, and then you have the complete deniers on the other. It's, again, the Fox News right. fallacy.
Because really what you're arguing for across these four issues is a sort of centrist, what yes. you guys would describe as a sort of centrist view on the four biggies that you think are holding Democrats back, race, immigration, trans rights, and
yes.
climate.
Yes, with race, an emphasis on ending discrimination. And I'm dealing with, again, both the blacks, Hispanics, whites who've been left behind in the society, but doing it again in a kind of quasi-universal way, not doing policies that single out, we're just going to help blacks. We're not going to help people in rural Ohio, or white. We're just going to help people in the west side of Chicago. And, you might make some kind of moral argument, but politically that's not going to happen. And what you're going to end up doing is helping no one. So
on race, your argument politically, the sweet spot is economics, essentially.
Yeah. And again, an economics of class. And, you know, with affirmative action, I have to look this up, but as I remember, Biden was against the Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action, which if you look at it, it's very popular in the country. And the alternative to a race-based affirmative action should be a class-based, that if kids face special obstacles getting an education and still excel.
In the conclusion of the book, you sum up by saying that Dems should focus on liberal economics, and that the reason they don't is twofold. One is that when they're in power, they're heavily influenced by Wall Street and Silicon Valley, and two, the influence of the cultural radicals in the shadow party and their organizations. And you and Rui argue that they need to be, liberal on economics and moderate and conciliatory on cultural issues such as race, immigration, gender, and climate. Two questions here. One, if they're not doing this, there's got to be a reason. And I'm skeptical that the only reason is the strength of the interest groups, that there's... So when you look at this coalition that you think is available to Democrats, what would they lose by doing this? That's the first thing I'm curious about. Or what are the arguments that you hear the most about why they don't do this? And then two, do you see any Democrat out there that has this view of the world and that someone who might be the future of the party rather than the past? And maybe the answer is Joe Biden. Because I think he does actually in a lot of ways.
In trying to understand the New Deal majority and why it worked, John Kenneth Galbraith introduced this idea of countervailing power. So that both in the workplace and in Washington in politics and in the state government as well, you had the power of business, that's not going to go away, but you also had the power of labor. You had other things attached to it as well. You had social groups, you had farm orders, but there had to be some kind of countervailing power. We don't have that in the United States anymore. The way that it could be revived is first, you have, and the problem is that they're interconnected. It has to happen on the one hand in the workplace and community, and on the other hand in a political party. Now, the labor movement has argued for years that what they need is some change in the labor law. So companies can't just fire organizers. So they can't just stall in terms of after an election in terms of having collective bargaining. One thing that I would prescribe is that when the Democrats do get a cloture-proof majority, 60 seats in the Senate and a majority in the House, as they had under Clinton and then Obama, that they reform the labor laws. Now, Obama was being pressured to do that in 2009, and he got a message from three of his billionaire funders, one of whom, Penny Pritzker, became Secretary of Commerce, that he better not do this. And sure enough, it became a low priority. He was for it, but so
this is
you
a,
have
this
to have this.
The PRO Act, yeah. Is that what it's called?
A wish?
The version of currently, is it called the PRO Act?
Yeah, PRO Act. But there's been different versions of it. It goes back to the 1970s, to Carter. That was the first big defeat. And the Democrats recognized that then if they didn't do that, it was going to rip the heart out of the party. And you want to have a kind of economic democracy in the country. You have to have the power within the workplace and the power within the political arena. And they go together. So it's going to be very hard to achieve that.
Who might represent this version of the Democratic Party?
Oh, I think, you know, I think Sherrod Brown understands that stuff really well.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is that within the Republican Party now, they have their own little shadow party organizations that have recognized that, oh my God, we have all these working class constituents.
Maybe we should do something for them.
Yes. Exactly. Maybe it's not just a matter of saying that we're against, you know, that we're against abortion or whatever.
Well, yeah, it's some of the stuff that Ross, our old friends Ross Douthat and Rehan Salam,
wrote about, they started, but now you have American Affairs, a journal. You have American Compass. You have Compact, a magazine, and you have these you know, I'd say Vance, Hawley, Rubio, all have elements of that politics. Now, they also have the Trump baggage, too, and this, you know, the Stop the Steal. But there is that faction within the Republican Party.
But when you look at if you look at any of the reporting on what that world wants to do in 2025 if Trump wins, frankly, it's not a lot of this. It's a lot of, let's get vengeance against the people who.
Well, I mean, you don't even have to look. Trump wins. Yeah. What was the first thing that the Republican Congress did when it came back in 2023?
Tax code to
favor their rich donors. Right. They wanted to change it.
Because the pre-Trump party still controlled the legislative apparatus.
So both parties have that same problem, and there's factions and there's politicians within both parties.
But by now, the Trump, what you're talking about, this sort of group, they should have worked through some of this, given how long Trump's been on the scene and what an opening they have with working class voters and how many Republicans like J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio and some of these and Josh Hawley now self-identify as, Republicans who represent working class voters.
I mean, they're
think
going,
they'd be a little further along in working out some ideas.
They still have the evangelicals are a huge base. The Koch network is a huge base, donor base within the
holding them back. The libertarians,
absolutely,
the religious
libertarians.
Right.
So, I mean, we could have had the same conversation about the Republicans and their shadow party that we've had about the Democrats. Both parties are basically have these extremes, and then there's this guy Trump, who's a kind of, it's very hard to characterize him within the history of American politics.
Oh, no doubt. John, audience should know, one of my oldest friends in Washington, someone who I have been reading and admiring for decades, more than two decades now. And thank you very much for doing this. It's been great to talk.
Great. I enjoyed it.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. Email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.